Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
Obama says Russia to suffer Ukraine costs. And new data indicates missing jet crashed into the Indian Ocean. I'm Bob Doty reporting from Washington. U.S. President Barack Obama says the United States and Europe are united in seeking to impose a cost on Russia for its actions in Ukraine. Mr. Obama spoke to reporters in the Netherlands ahead of an emergency meeting of the Group of Seven, or G7, focused on Russia's annexation of Crimea. Analysts say the session appears aimed at coordinating Western sanctions imposed on Moscow since Russian troops crossed into Crimea earlier this month. The group is also expected to assess the cost of any retaliatory measures by Moscow. President Obama said Monday that Europe and the United States are united in support of the Ukrainian government and the Ukrainian people. The comments came after he met with Dutch Prime Minister Mark Rutte in Amsterdam.
Europe and America are united in our support of the Ukrainian government and the Ukrainian people. We're united in imposing a cost on Russia for its actions so far.
The U.S. President's Deputy National Security Advisor Ben Rhodes told reporters Mr. Obama and other G7 leaders will use the meeting to foreshadow the economic sanctions Russia will face if it continues down this course. Malaysia says a new analysis of satellite data indicates its missing passenger jet crashed into the southern Indian Ocean. Malaysian Prime Minister Najib Razak said Monday that a more thorough examination of the flight's path, based on satellite data collected by a British company, showed that Malaysia Airlines Flight 370 plunged into the water in a remote location of Perth.
It is therefore with deep sadness and regret that I must inform you that according to this new data, Flight MH370 ended in the southern Indian Ocean.
He said that relatives of the 239 people on board the planned flight from Kuala Lumpur to Beijing had been told of the fate of the Boeing 777. Japan will hand over hundreds of kilograms of weapons-grade uranium and plutonium to the United States as part of efforts to reduce global stockpiles of sensitive atomic material. U.S. President Barack Obama and Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe announced the deal Monday at a two-day nuclear security summit in The Hague. In a joint statement, the leaders said all highly enriched uranium and separated plutonium will be removed from the fast critical assembly at the Japan Atomic Energy Agency. Japan's special nuclear advisor told reporters removing the nuclear material will help in preventing the risk of nuclear terrorism, a focus of the summit. The United States is more than doubling its deployment of special operations forces to help search for warlord Joseph Kony. President Barack Obama ordered about 150 troops and at least four CV-22 aircraft to Uganda on Sunday, marking the first time the U.S. has sent military planes to find Kony and his fighters. Mr. Obama first sent about 100 U.S. Special Forces to the region in 2011, where they have been supporting a 5,000-member African Union regional task force. The Pentagon says the U.S. troops are tasked with providing information and assistance and are armed only for self-defense. Kony is wanted by the International Criminal Court for 33 counts of war crimes and crimes against humanity. Hopes are diminishing for finding survivors of a U.S. mudslide that has killed at least 8 people and left as many as 108 others missing. Rescue workers continued their search Monday of a large quicksand-like debris pile in the northwestern state of Washington. One survivor was caught up in this wall of mud, trees, and rocks as it cascaded through a rural community north of Seattle on Saturday morning.
There was literally a 20-foot wall of mud racing across the valley. We were tumbled inside and had mud in our eyes and nose and mouth, and I'm really grateful I'm alive.
A fire department spokesman said late Sunday that rescuers did not hear any signs of life in the debris pile. 18 people have been reported missing, but that was before rescue workers found 5 bodies Sunday, pushing the death toll to 8. For more news and information, visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Bob Doty reporting.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
In what's being called the biggest capital punishment verdict by Egypt's judiciary, 529 supporters of ousted President Mohamed Morsi have been sentenced to death. The hasty decision threatens to further deepen Egypt's political divide.
That's VOA's Elizabeth Arrett reporting from Cairo. We'll have full details on this story coming up. Also, the U.S. deploys additional military personnel and aircraft to Uganda to support operations to track down the Lord's Resistance Army. Health officials say an outbreak of hemorrhagic fever linked to the Ebola virus has now killed 59 people in Guinea. And a new study estimates that every year, 1 million children worldwide become infected with TB. We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from South Africa, and our feature reports. Stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, in what is being called the biggest capital punishment verdict by Egypt's judiciary, 529 supporters of ousted President Mohamed Morsi have been sentenced to death. VOA's Elizabeth Arrett reports from Cairo. The hasty decision threatens to further deepen Egypt's political divide.
The condemned were convicted of killing a policeman, attacking others, and destroying property. The sentencing came after just two court sessions, and before the defendants' lawyers say they were permitted to make their case. The majority was condemned in absentia, with fewer than 200 of those on trial in court. 16 suspects were acquitted. An appeal is permitted, and given the rushed circumstances of the trial, human rights and legal experts believe the verdict is unlikely to stand. Even members of the government-linked National Council for Human Rights condemned the verdict. Member Nasser Amin wrote on Twitter, "The court ruling will be overturned as soon as the defendants demand a retrial." Other legal rights advocates described it as a disaster and a scandal. Many of those on trial were arrested during fighting in the southern province of Minya, where the trial was held, after security forces dispersed Muslim Brotherhood protest camps last August in Cairo. Hundreds, possibly more, died in the crackdown, most of them supporters of the Muslim Brotherhood and Mohamed Morsi, Egypt's first freely elected leader. Thousands of Morsi's supporters have been jailed since. Caught up in the crackdown are several journalists, including Australian journalist Peter Grest, Egyptian-Canadian Mohamed Fahmy, and Egyptian Bahar Mohamed of the Qatar-based Al Jazeera network. They're on trial in a Cairo court charged with aiding what the government considers the terrorist Muslim Brotherhood. The defendants deny the charges, saying they were simply reporting the news. Grest's brother, Mike Grest, was at the court as the trial continued Monday.
"We don't believe that the prosecution will be able to present any evidence to substantiate any of their charges. And more importantly, I'm hoping that another court date gets set down sooner rather than later."
The men were arrested late last year in a case that has attracted denunciations from media rights groups and others around the world. Monday's court proceedings come as Egyptian officials say the campaign for a permanent replacement for Morsi, himself on trial in several other court cases, will begin in the coming days. Egyptian officials have put strong restrictions on media coverage, leaving Egyptian news dominated by praise of the military-backed government, in particular defense minister and widely assumed future presidential candidate General Abdel Fattah el-Sisi. Anger over Morsi's 1 year in power remains high among many Egyptians, who blame him and his Brotherhood supporters for their often violent exclusion from Egypt's political process and attempting to impose a narrowly based Islamist rule. Publisher and political commentator Hisham Qasim:
"The Brotherhood decided to step out of the process. You know, it's them that should be asked to be inclusive."
But any attempts at bringing the group and its millions of supporters back into the political fold will likely be harder after Monday's verdicts. Elizabeth Arendt, VOA News, Cairo.
The United States is deploying additional military personnel and aircraft to Uganda to support operations to track down the Lord's Resistance Army, LRA, rebel group. VOA's Gabe Joslow reports that catching the group's elusive leader, Joseph Kony, may still prove a challenge.
As first reported by the Washington Post, U.S. officials say the military is sending 150 Special Forces personnel and four Osprey tilt-rotor aircraft to assist African forces in operations against the LRA. The new deployment, expected this week, adds to an existing contingent of U.S. Special Forces based in Uganda, working alongside African militaries from the region. Ugandan military spokesman Paddy Ankunda tells VOA the new aircraft will help African forces more quickly dispatch soldiers to the remote areas where the LRA is believed to be hiding.
One of our greatest difficulties, one of our greatest problems has been airlift. Our ability to airlift personnel and material has been limited. But now, with this deployment, it's going to be solved.
The LRA, infamous for forced recruitment of child soldiers and a cult-like Christian-influenced ideology, has declined in recent years to an estimated 250 fighters who travel in bands across Central Africa. The group's leader, Joseph Kony, is wanted by the International Criminal Court for crimes including murder and sexual enslavement. He is thought to be hiding out in the Central African Republic. Casper Agger, a field researcher with the Enough Project, which monitors conflict in the region, says instability in the CAR following a coup last year has created ideal conditions for the group to thrive.
This is the dream scenario for Kony and the LRA. As long as there's instability and conflict in the areas where they are, then it provides, we can say, a smokescreen for them to continue to hide.
Some groups of LRA fighters also reportedly operate in the Democratic Republic of Congo and have been previously active in South Sudan. U.S. forces first deployed to the region in 2011 as military advisors armed only for self-defense. Since then, several of Kony's top commanders have been captured or have defected. Agger says the new deployment could be a game-changer in terms of catching Kony, but cautions against being overly optimistic.
This guy is a survivor and he's been able to stay alive for all these years, and you can put yourself in a position where you increase your odds of getting Kony, but you also need a lot of luck for it to happen.
The U.S. military has made the counter-LRA operations a major focus of its Africa command. Congress approved $37.5 million for the effort in this year's defense budget. Gabe Joselow, VOA News, Nairobi.
Coming up on 13 minutes past the hour, this is Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. The death toll in a weekend boating accident in Uganda's Lake Albert is now more than 100. Regional police say the boat was overcrowded with an estimated 150 Congolese refugees when it tipped over in the middle of the lake on Saturday. Police have recovered 107 victims. They do not expect to find any survivors. Large numbers of civilians have sought haven in Uganda during years of violence in the neighboring DRC. Health officials say an outbreak of hemorrhagic fever linked to the Ebola virus has now killed 59 people in Guinea. The World Health Organization reports a total of 86 suspected Ebola cases in Guinea, 13 of which have been confirmed by lab results. The outbreak has been centered in rural parts of southeastern Guinea, including the areas of Gekido and Macenta. The WHO said on its Twitter feed today that tests for two suspected cases in the capital, Conakry, came back negative. Ebola is one of the most highly contagious viral diseases and causes symptoms that include high fever, vomiting, diarrhea, and bleeding. Health officials say caretakers should minimize direct or close contact with infected patients and wash their hands frequently. An Ebola outbreak in Uganda in 2012 killed at least 16 people. On this World TB Day, there's some sobering news about children and tuberculosis. A new study estimates that every year, 1 million children worldwide become infected with TB. That's twice previous World Health Organization estimates and three times the number of youngsters who are reported, diagnosed, and treated for the disease annually. More concerning still is news that 32,000 children are sick with multidrug-resistant tuberculosis, which is extremely difficult to treat. VOA's Jessica Berman has details.
Experts say there's a narrow window for identifying and treating children with the disease. Unlike adults who carry the bacterium in a latent form for many years before becoming ill, public health officials say kids infected with TB can become sick very rapidly and may die before ever seeing a doctor. Part of the problem is tuberculosis is very difficult to diagnose in children, according to Mercedes Becerra, a professor of global health and social medicine at Harvard Medical School in Boston. Becerra says the conventional sputum test used to successfully diagnose TB in adults doesn't work very well in children. The test looks for the presence of bacteria in a sample of mucus coughed up by patients. But Becerra, a senior author of the report on kids and TB published in the journal The Lancet, says the sputum test is not sensitive enough to pick up the disease in all youngsters.
Children have less bacteria, and their disease is actually different than adults. Tuberculosis presents differently.
In children, Becerra says the TB bacteria often do not stay confined to the lungs. Often the disease spreads to other parts of the body, including the brain and bone marrow. Becerra and colleagues at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston first looked into the number of cases of multidrug-resistant TB in children. In the course of combing through regional and global estimates, they found around 1 million children overall developed TB in 2010, approximately double official estimates. Of these, researchers discovered more than 30,000 pediatric cases were drug resistant. Because children usually become infected with tuberculosis through exposure to sick adults, Becerra says many cases of TB could be prevented by thoroughly screening those who come in contact with patients, including children. Otherwise, Becerra says failure to examine children is a missed opportunity to treat and prevent tuberculosis.
Every single child with TB is a warning signal that TB transmission is ongoing around that child and that children are not getting preventive therapy.
Becerra says most cases of tuberculosis occur in China, Russia, and India, but she says children are becoming infected with tuberculosis anywhere adults are sick with the disease. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
17 minutes past the hour. This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Four young Muslims were killed in the Central African Republic capital, Bangui, over the weekend, among them a son and a brother of an important community leader, the mayor of the city's third district. Their friends and relatives are asking why international peacekeepers are not permanently stationed on the front line between their community and a neighboring hostile district. Nick Long reports from Bangui.
Grave diggers prepare the earth inside the compound of Atahiro Baladodo, the mayor of Bangui's third district. The bodies of the mayor's son and brother could not be buried at the Muslim cemetery because it is in the neighbouring Boeing district, now controlled by hostile forces. On Sunday, friends and relatives filed past the bodies laid out on white sheets, and hundreds of people attended a brief religious ceremony outside the house. Two other young men were also killed Saturday. All four were part of the Muslim Self-Defense Force. Baladodo tells the OA they were called out three times on Saturday to respond to threats. The first attack was at 6 a.m., the second at 10:30, and at about 1:30 p.m., he says, his boys went out again. He says African Union peacekeepers arrived on the scene for the first attack, and so did the French peacekeepers at 10 a.m., but they were not there when the third attack came, when the two young men died. A relative, Mahamadou Baba, says the French peacekeepers, known as Sangaris, should have responded more strongly.
Les Sangaris étaient là, donc les ex-FAK, les anti-balaka tiraient sur eux ici.
Sangaris were there, he says, and they were fired at by the anti-Balaka militia and by ex-Central African Army soldiers. He says they fired back and advanced to the Boeing district and stayed in the area a couple of hours with their helicopters flying over. But he doesn't understand why the militia fighters weren't dislodged. We're astonished, he says, that there's no permanent presence of Sangaris or of the African Union Mission MISCA on that side of our district, because that's the hotspot where most of the attacks come from. There are only some 10,000 to 15,000 Muslims left in Bangui out of an estimated 150,000 before communal violence flared last year. And nearly all of them are forced to live in a ghetto, the so-called Kilometre 5 area of the 3rd arrondissement. A spokesman for the French mission, Lieutenant Colonel Thomas Mollard, tells VOA that while the Sangaris do not have a base in the 3rd arrondissement, the mission has a permanent presence and has patrols there night and day. MISCA, he points out, does have a base in the district. A MISCA officer acknowledged that their base is not on the side facing the Boeing district, which local people say is the front line. Asked why the international forces are not permanently at this hot point, Lieutenant Colonel Mollard said the CAR is a country of rumours, and while local people may perceive threats as coming from Boeing district, the attackers might in fact be from another district. He confirmed there has been a resurgence of tension in Bangui in the past few days. Nick Long for VOA News, Bangui.
The militant group known as Boko Haram has waged a nearly five-year insurgency in northern Nigeria. The government launched a military offensive against the sect in May 2013, but attacks against civilians have intensified. Now some observers wonder what Boko Haram really wants and whether the insurgency has spun out of control. VOA's Anne Look has this report from our West Africa Bureau.
Boko Haram's response to the now 10-month-long military offensive has included an increase in attacks on civilians. Militants have raided villages, slaughtered travelers on the highway, and mowed down teenagers in school dormitories. The governor of Borno State said in March that Boko Haram is, quote, better armed and better motivated than the Nigerian military. The question is, motivated by what? The radical sect was founded in the early 2000s, with the goal of bringing pure Islamic rule to the Muslim-majority northeast. But the brutality of the past year raises the question, is this a fight for a cause, or is it just a murderous rampage?
That's the question everybody is asking. What does Boko Haram want?
Some say years of corruption and deepening poverty have fueled the sect. But Frederick Mabufo, a Nigerian newspaper columnist and social commentator, argues that Boko Haram was born out of what he calls the ultra-religiousness of Nigerian society. He doesn't think they have lost sight of their original goals, despite what he calls their more aggressive tactics.
Now, they're trying to bite any way they can. That is what we're seeing. But it doesn't change the fundamental thing that Boko Haram is fighting for. They're fighting for control. That is what they want. They want control. He believes that Sharia law should be the rule, should be what should guide Nigerians, should be what the state should live by.
Nigeria's military has painted Boko Haram as increasingly disorganized and on the run. Analysts tell VOA otherwise. They say the pattern and organization of attacks over the past year indicate an intact command structure. Boko Haram has always been a constellation of factions and cells, some more moderate than others, some closer to al-Qaeda, and with more international jihadist agendas. A splinter group in Saru has kidnapped and killed Westerners. And yet so much about Boko Haram is simply not known. The group's origins are somewhat clear. The sect's founder, Imam Muhammad Yusuf, had a cult-like following. He preached in the open until 2009. His sermons made the rounds of the north for years, via cell phones and DVDs. He preached against Western civilization and what he said was a corrupt Nigerian elite. He said the solution was a pure Islamic state in the north. He preached jihad. The group launched an uprising in July 2009, sparking a bloody police crackdown in which Yusuf was arrested and killed. At least 700 people died in this initial bout of fighting. Yusuf's deputy Abubakar Shekau took over the sect. In a video in July 2010, he declared that, quote, jihad has only just begun. Shekau became the public face of the now clandestine group, sending out messages by video. Experts say a desire for retribution against those who allegedly betrayed the group has become a recurrent theme. The group's list of declared enemies has only grown. But while the sect's tactics have evolved over the years, its core causes have not disappeared. Shekau talks about them in a recent video released in February. His speech is punctuated by gunshots. The Quran must be supreme, he says. We must establish Islam in this country. He makes some new threats, but he also covers familiar territory. He vows to kill Christians wherever they find them and claims responsibility for killing a Nigerian Islamic cleric who opposed them. He threatens other prominent Nigerians. He calls them, quote, infidels. What makes you infidels, he says, is, quote, democracy and constitution and Western education. He says Boko Haram, quote, enjoys shedding their blood. That again raises the question, is all this violence really just a means to an end? Anne Luck, VOA News, Dakar.
The Food and Agriculture Organization says Africa is the world's most food-insecure continent. The UN agency is holding its 28th regional conference on Africa this week in Tunis. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
The FAO gave the bleak description of Africa despite some strong economic growth in recent years. An average 4.8% increase in gross domestic product, or GDP, between 2000 and 2010. It says the problem stems from low agricultural productivity, low incomes in rural areas, and high rates of malnutrition. There have been improvements, though. The FAO cites greater production of staple crops, the growing of better varieties of bananas in eastern and central Africa, and the planting of higher-yielding maize. There's also greater production of cotton, teas, and flowers. But the agency says it's not enough to ensure food security for a growing population amid climate change. FAO Assistant Director General Bukar Tijani says the conference is focusing on greater investment in smallholder farmers. Women play the major role in such farms. But Tijani says there will now be an emphasis on attracting youth.
The theme of the conference itself is really to support youth in different endeavors of agriculture. But then we have to be very precise. We have to also be pulling youth into agriculture, because agriculture is seen as a traditional historical culture and not as farming or as enterprise or as business.
The FAO says agricultural production in African countries, on average, has increased slightly less than 1% per year, compared with about 2% in other developing countries. Tijani says Africa's youth must see that agriculture is big business, not just a tradition. Entrepreneurship, he says, can be applied to agricultural products.
That is crops, livestock, fishery, forest products, and the value chain activities related to it, including technologies, communication, ICT, everything that could attract youth into it, because it's big money.
Representatives of more than 50 countries are expected to attend the FAO regional meeting in Tunis. They're being asked to build on the continent's economic growth to provide stable agriculture and fiscal policies that encourage investment.
The future of Africa or any generation lies in the youth, and that is why I'm calling on youth to come into agribusiness so that you can have employment generation, wealth creation, incomes within agriculture across Africa.
The meeting also addresses policies to end hunger on the continent by 2025. The FAO says over the past decades, absolute levels of hunger and undernourishment remain worrying in sub-Saharan Africa. It adds the Sahel and the Horn of Africa are of particular concern. The regional meeting in Tunis runs until March 28th. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and it's 29 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
VOA podcasts are a convenient way to get your information on the run.
VOAAfrica.com.
Visit VOAAfrica.com and subscribe to our podcast service.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. 529 supporters of ousted President Mohamed Morsi have been sentenced to death. Health officials say an outbreak of hemorrhagic fever linked to the Ebola virus has now killed 59 people in Guinea. And a new study estimates that every year, 1 million children worldwide become infected with tuberculosis. Coming up, we'll have music from South Africa and our feature reports. I'm Kim Lewis, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. It's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. And happy Monday, Sunny.
Happy Monday to you, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand a dynamic duo in African football tops your sports report.
Kim, two of Africa's greatest footballers, Samuel Eto'o of Cameroon and Yaya Toure of Ivory Coast, who will both play at June's World Cup in Brazil, both had big games over the weekend in the English Premier League. Four-time African Footballer of the Year Eto'o scored the first goal in Chelsea's 6-0 thrashing of Arsenal. Eto'o and the Blues of Chelsea are bidding for their fifth EPL title. They're currently 4 points ahead of Liverpool and 6 points ahead of Manchester City, but Man City has played three fewer matches. Two-time African Footballer of the Year Yaya Toure made sure Man City kept pace in the exciting EPL race. Yaya scored a hat trick in Man City's 5-0 rout of bottom of the table Fulham. The rugged Toure converted two penalty kicks and curled in his third goal in the 65th minute. We look forward to Toure and Eto'o scoring a few more goals at the World Cup in Brazil. We're now 80 days away to the kickoff of football's premier event. Emergency repairs are underway on the pitch at Amazonia Arena in the Brazilian city of Manaus. The venue will stage 4 World Cup group matches, including Samuel Eto'o's Cameroon team versus Croatia on June 18th. The damage to the playing surface was caused by high temperatures, humidity, and misuse of fertilizer. A local spokesman told the French news agency that grass was replanted in areas affected to help speed up the recovery process. Joining us with more World Cup news is our Nightline Africa sportsman, Segun Dot, on the spot at Adeyemi.
Tournament organizers and World Soccer's governing body, FIFA, performed an embarrassing U-turn and apologized, saying it had withdrawn publicity material for the World Cup that poked fun at local customs. FIFA says it has removed material which depicted Brazilians as unpunctual, impatient, and even chaotic. Having regularly complained to Brazil about the slow pace of construction of stadiums for the World Cup, football's world governing body felt moved to add, in Brazil, things are largely done last minute. FIFA admitted its attempt at humor had backfired. The material was lighthearted and at no time was meant to criticize Brazil, a FIFA statement said. It says the objective was to show the laid-back characteristics of the Brazilian people. Meanwhile, Brazil is to declare no-fly zones over the stadiums to be used for the World Cup to prevent terrorist attacks during the tournament. But there is a catch. The Brazilian Air Force that will enforce the no-fly zones can't shoot down intruders for now. By law, Brazil's military can only shoot at unresponsive civilian planes on drug trafficking routes near its borders, but not over densely populated urban areas where games will be played in 12 cities. The Air Force is asking the Brazilian government to change the shoot-down law to allow effective defense of the airspace during the 64 games of the June 12th to July 13th Global Soccer Tournament. And Brazil's first World Cup winning captain has died. Eldorado Luiz Bellini, who captained the triumphant 1958 side, has died in Sao Paulo at the age of 83. He had been suffering from Alzheimer's for many years. Bellini led a side including players such as Garrincha, Zagallo, and a 17-year-old Pelé. The Brazilians beat host Sweden 5-2 in the final to win the first of a record 5 World Cup titles. Bellini was part of the squad that lifted the trophy in Chile 4 years later, although he never played in that tournament. He got the last of his 51 caps at the 1966 World Cup in England. A statue built outside Rio de Janeiro's Maracanã Stadium, which will host the 2014 World Cup final on July 13th, shows Bellini holding aloft the trophy he led his team to win in 1958.
The Voice of America, VOA.
Let's now head to Dakar, the capital city of the West African nation of Senegal. That's where African sports journalists gathered during the past week for their congress under the platform of the African chapter of the International Sports Press Association, AIPS. Organizers say the congress set a record in the number of countries that were represented. They say journalists from 21 countries were present, compared with the highest of 15 countries previously recorded. Michel Obi is the president of the AIPS Africa. He calls the record attendance a good beginning for an association that has been struggling to find its level. Obi also spoke of the overall objectives of the Congress.
This Congress for us, it's a turning point in the direction of the way we want African sports journalists to not only match their counterparts globally, but also to find a new way of using technology and also changing her professional approach to working, to making the best of her situation and also giving value to sports journalism. So for us, it's a turning point in the way we perceive our profession and the way we handle our profession and the way we are going to do our profession. This Congress at least will fashion a new vision, a new direction. For me particularly, it's my first Congress as the president of AIPS, and I want to believe that it's time for us to go to work. It's time for us to work and make our Congress a true journalistic engagement, one that will be the pride of all sports journalists, not only in the continent, but also African journalists outside.
That was the president, African chapter of the International Sports Press Association, AIPS, Michel Obi. Many thanks to reporter Tony Atkins for the audio. In African athletics, Mustafa Al-Gamel of Egypt has smashed the African hammer record. Al-Gamel added 66 centimeters to the African record on Friday, throwing a world-leading 81.29 meters at a low-key competition in the Egyptian capital, Cairo. The 25-year-old added more than 3 meters to his previous best of 77.73 meters set last year at the Solidarity Games, in breaking the African record of 80.63 meters set by South Africa's Chris Harms in 2005, Al-Gamel also surpassed the Egyptian record of 78.21 meters set last year by compatriot Hassan Mohamed Mahmoud. Thanks a lot for listening. For the Sunny Side of Sports, this is Segun Adeyemi in Lagos.
Joining us now with more African athletic news is our Daybreak Africa sportsman, Mark Ouma.
Ugandan John Cheptegei won the men's race at the World University Cross Country Championships in Entebbe, Uganda on Saturday. Kenyans Daniel Muindi and Calvin Chemoi were followed. Meanwhile, Winnie Nanyondo, Dorcas Ajok and Prim Twikiriza made it a 1-2-3 Ugandan medal podium sweep in the women's race. Kenya won the men's team event. Uganda was second, followed by defending champions Japan, South Africa, Italy, Canada, France, China, Sri Lanka and Oman. Meanwhile, Uganda carried the day in the women's team event. Defending champions Japan were runners-up, followed by Canada, South Africa, Italy, France, Australia, Kenya and China. Meanwhile, Egyptian All-Africa Games champion Mustafa El Gamel set an Africa hammer throw record of 81.29 meters in Cairo, Egypt on Friday. The old mark of 80.63 meters was set by South African Chris Haramsa in 2005. Elsewhere, Kenyan world champion Yuni Sum and Mercy Cherono triumphed in the 800 meters and 1500 meters respectively at the IAAF World Challenge Series in Melbourne, Australia on Saturday. Other Kenyan victors were Isaiah Kiplangat Koech and James Kiplagat Magut in the men's 5,000 meters and 1,500 meters respectively. Kenya ya leo, Kenya ya leo, usipoka sana, takufa masikini. Kenya ya leo, haipendi uvivu, usipoka sana, takufa masikini. Kenya ya leo, Kenya ya leo, usipoka sana, takufa masikini.
This is the voice of America, Washington, D.C.
Hello, everybody. From that very first broadcast during World War II, and ever since, the voice of America has been the voice of freedom. So on behalf of the American people and the millions around the world who draw hope and strength from your work, thank you all for being the proud and steady voice of America.
Voice of America!
And thank you, President Obama, for your support of the Voice of America. Meanwhile, you might say President Obama's wife, Michelle Obama, recently engaged in some ping-pong diplomacy in Beijing, China. Mrs. Obama played some table tennis during a visit to Beijing Normal School, which prepares students for universities abroad. The First Lady is a big advocate of physical fitness, and one of her causes has been to fight childhood obesity. She and President Obama are also big sports fans, and they've attended various sporting events here in Washington and in other cities. Our VOA listeners will remember Mrs. Obama led the official U.S. delegation at the 2012 Olympics in London. I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the sunny side of sports. Back to Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny. And listen to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the sunny side of sports at 1730 hours UTC, right here on the Voice of America. Coming up, a new report shows Zimbabwe lags behind other African countries in respect for the rule of law. And a simple test for cervical cancer can save the lives of women in developing countries. First, let's listen to a little music. Here's Patricia Majalisa of South Africa with Cool Down.
Oh,
Patricia Majalisa of South Africa with Cool Down. Well, the World Justice Project has just released its 2014 Rule of Law Index. It reports that Zimbabwe is lagging behind other African countries in respect for the rule of law. The WJP Index measures how the rule of law is experienced in everyday life in 99 countries around the globe. The index measures 47 indicators, including constraint on government powers, absence of corruption, open government, fundamental rights, order, and security. Senior researcher Dawa Mafhinga of Human Rights Watch tells reporter Sandra Nayara he's not surprised by the findings on Zimbabwe.
There is no surprise at all on that front. Successive elections in Zimbabwe have not resulted in a paradigm shift in terms of the promotion of the rule of law and in terms of ensuring human rights respect across the country. What we have had have been choiceless elections that do not result in political change in terms of what direction the country should be going in. There is absolutely no political will in Zimbabwe to prioritize human rights respect, to prioritize good governance, to prioritize good economic governance for equitable justice for all the people in the country.
What can be done by all political players in Zimbabwe to make sure that the rule of law is respected as is being raised in that rule of law index?
The buck stops at President Mugabe's door. He must take decisive leadership in terms of moving the country away from dictatorship and prioritize the interests of the people of Zimbabwe. That is quite critical. And also, within political parties, within government, there is need for leadership renewal to ensure that there is the emergence of new ideas, new leaders with a new focus and drive and compassion for the people of Zimbabwe. These things must be in place for us to enjoy our basic rights as well as to enjoy the benefits of transparency, accountability and good governance.
The report singles out Ghana and Botswana as some of the countries or the only two top countries in Africa in terms of respecting the rule of law. What sets the two countries apart from the others?
Well, on the political front, you have clear leadership renewal. You have had political parties that changed their leadership. But more importantly, there is transparency and accountability in terms of the use of resources. If you look at Botswana, it is endowed with massive diamond resources, the same with Zimbabwe. But the difference is in how those resources are used for the benefit of the people. The people of citizens of Botswana receive grants and things like that, which is really not happening in Zimbabwe, where people are heavily taxed and there is loot and plunder of national resources by a few individuals who are aligned to ZANU-PF, mainly.
Dawa Mafhinga is senior researcher with Human Rights Watch. He spoke with Sandra Nayara of VOA's Zimbabwe program. In Africa, malaria, AIDS, and childbirth are among the leading killers of women. But there is also another killer, cervical cancer. VOA's Carol Pearson tells us about a simple test and technology that can save the lives of women in developing countries.
Every year around the globe, 500,000 women develop cervical cancer, and more than 250,000 die. The overwhelming majority of those deaths occur in developing countries. In Burkina Faso, Ajaratu Kinda learned too late that she had cervical cancer.
They said there is nothing else they can do for me here.
A simple, inexpensive test could have saved her life. In developed countries, most women can be screened for cervical cancer with a non-invasive test at a doctor's office. If lab results show abnormal cells, they have options: cryotherapy, killing precancerous cells by freezing the cervix, and in more advanced cases, radiation or surgery. In developing countries, women don't have these options. As a result, in sub-Saharan Africa, women who are HIV positive are surviving AIDS, but dying of cervical cancer.
This is a healthy cervix?
Dr.
Here.
John Varallo is with JAPIGO, a nonprofit health organization.
In a precancer stage, there are no symptoms. There's no pain, there's no bleeding, there's no discharge. Woman feels well. And so, but that's when they need to be screened.
JAPYGO is helping establish programs in Burkina Faso and other countries so doctors, nurses, and midwives can screen and treat precancerous cells in one visit. A solution of simple table vinegar turns precancerous cells white. During that same visit, cryotherapy kills them.
Abnormal areas or precancerous lesions will turn a thick white, and so it's very clear in most cases.
It takes 10 years or more for those cells to become cancerous, and yet cervical cancer is the second leading cause of cancer deaths among women worldwide.
It's projected that by 2030, 98% of those cases will be occurring in developing countries, and it's really unnecessary, because cervical cancer is almost completely preventable.
The World Health Organization calls cervical cancer a leading public health concern. And now, with an inexpensive test, more women can be screened and their lives saved. Dr. Varallo says the procedure is 95% effective. If screening and treatment can become more widespread, there will be no need for women like Ajara Tukinda to learn that it's too late. Carol Pearson, VOA News.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next is our VOA editorial. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer Bill Workinger and our engineer Wagner Roberts, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Women, youth, and civil society are fundamental to the post-2015 development agenda at the United Nations. The U.S. representative to the U.N. Economic and Social Council, Ambassador Elizabeth Cousins, said if we are serious about tackling inequalities and exclusion, and if we are serious about a truly transformative development agenda, we need women, girls, and youth to be at the heart and soul of our work. There has been considerable progress in creating greater access to education and improving some health outcomes. However, progress has been uneven, and women and girls are among the most falling behind. Women make up the majority of young people unable to read or write. They lack equal access to jobs and livelihoods, and they face persistent discrimination and inequality in many areas. Women and girls continue to face early and forced marriage, health risks from childbirth, underrepresentation in political decision-making and institutions, and the pervasive scourge of violence. Nearly one in three women globally are beaten, coerced into sex, or physically abused in some other way. Investing in women has many development benefits. A child born to a mother who can read and write, for example, is 50% more likely to survive past the age of five. It is crucial that the post-2015 development agenda target quality education, increase political participation, and the elimination of sexual-based violence, including early and forced marriage. Today, youth make up more than half the world's population, yet far too many live in conditions of insecurity, poverty, or vulnerability that limits their prospects. Development goals need to target their specific needs, including addressing the issue of vocational skills, as upwards of 75 million youth are unemployed globally. Finally, the bedrock of all these development efforts is civil society. Governments and institutions are stronger when citizens have a voice in public policy debates and decision-making that affects them. If we care about advancing a shared development agenda, said Ambassador Cousins, we must continue to press for a safe and open environment for civil society and citizen action. The United States strongly supports the inclusion in the post-2015 development agenda of women and girls, youth, and the institutions that promote healthy civil society.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.
Hello, Africa. I'm James Partey, host of Daybreak Africa. Join me every weekday mornings at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC as we bring you the latest in African news, features, and sports.
My name is Edward Ameyibo. I listen to Daybreak Africa to be abreast with developments on the continent. I encourage you to do the same.
You can also be a part of the show through our listeners' mail segment. Just send your views to daybreakafrica@voanews.com or call us on 202-205-9942. That's Daybreak Africa, your breakfast show at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC on the Voice of America.